What?
The tasty combo. Welcome, everybody. It's Vibrant Time, Wednesday night, 7 p.m. Central. Everybody's favorite show. And I've got, I'm just so grateful. I'm like overflowing. I'm even feeling like a bit high off of it. Just this combination of gentlemen. I know we're going to have so much fun, and we don't even have a slight plan of what to talk about. Although Kyle's already sent me something totally far out. A slick dissident, Tippecanoe Herbs collaborative idea. Loving it. So yeah, welcome everyone. Happy to see everyone in the chat. Third Eye Edify, Old World Micmac, Jerusha McBear, My Cherie, and Liam, Priscilla, you guys rock. Thanks for being here and showing up on time. And if you would like to do us a solid, share the stream with somebody that you know would like it, or a good group, I would appreciate it. And I'm just here for the gravy. I'm in the audience tonight. What's up and welcome, everybody.
What's up? Nice to see you, Topher.
Nice to see you, my man, Kyle. How you doing?
Doing great tonight. I'm doing great.
Did the Arctic blast like make your nipples super hard?
The hardest in the house, probably. And probably. I have a breastfeeding wife. The
an Italian breastfeeding wife.
It went from 70 degrees to 19 degrees in just a matter of a couple hours, you could see it coming from 30,000 miles away or whatever. There's just planning all week long for this thing. So, yep.
And that's the show, folks. Good night, everyone.
Topher, I can't hear you. Are you muted?
Oh, let me see.
Oh, you're not muted.
Yeah, we don't hear you though. I was messing with this volume, but it shouldn't have stopped him. Unplug it and plug it back in. So I will say, while we wait for Topher to figure that out, that I recently checked out the newest episode of his podcast, Biocharisma, which if you're not following, you ought to be. And he spoke with Eileen McCusick, my personal hero and idol and guru. And I really loved that conversation. Yeah, Topher.
Okay.
There you
are.
Can
you hear me now?
Mm. Yep, we're good now.
Dude, there's something with my...
No, you're gone again.
It's my fault. I'm like adjusting the volume to try to make it what I think it should be. And then when I clicked the adjustment, he disappeared off of the sound. Okay. That's the problem. I'm not going to touch it anymore. I think you're good.
Am I here?
Yep. There you are.
Dude, am I here? So dude, the weather thing, year and a half of watching stuff in the Ozarks, there is never a front that isn't induced. I've yet to see one natural frontal boundary occur. I don't think any of this weather is natural. Not one iota of it.
No, I absolutely agree, because I got my eye on the sky too, and I'm in the city, but I keep my eye on the sky, and I could really tell there's what's happening manipulating it above me, but what's happening around me, the pressure differential and everything like that that's created. So we were right on the edge, at least where my town was, right on the edge of that front. And it was like really intense, because we're like Lake Michigan is only like a mile to the east of me. So it's like there's a lot of energy in this particular area to be diffused outwards into the Great Lakes. So, but it was pretty fun, because I've been reading stories to my son, and that have like lightning bolts and thunder in them, like little kids stories. So it was fun to like watch the lightning and the thunder and overcome fear from a very early age about that kind of thing, and just feel like just have a really fun lesson about bravery and the excitement of the excitement of nature, even if it is manipulated. You know, there still is some fun to be had in that, and some, I don't know, I think maybe after all, that's really the lesson. You know.
Yeah. So speaking of fun, can I share a theory with you guys?
One sec. I want to shout out Marty Leeds at the Gnostic Church and Academy. You're talking about reading stories to your boy. And I don't know if you guys saw this, but Marty, I'm going to screen share the cover of it, but Marty just put out his first children's book Little Simon Petey and the Amazing Adventures of Grandpapa. And this is basically like a just something to read to your kid where a grandpa is telling tall tales to his grandson and they seem unbelievable. But then, you know, you find out as you go through it that he's actually telling the story of the stars. So it's like astro theology for kids and it's really cool. So check that out. Gnostic Academy of Lord Jesus Christ. And if you're looking for a good children's book for your kiddos, this seems like something that would have a lot of value. And like as they grew up and they knew they loved this book and you could kind of explain it to them a little more deeply what it all means. I want one and I'm not even a kiddo. So kid at heart, maybe. I had to shout that out.
That's
what's
awesome.
Numbers of the title. I wonder if he thought about that a lot, you know, like the gematria of the title. And so that it would be like the most magical release of a children's book.
Well, that's why he wrote Paw with a W. That had a gematria reason behind it. He does Sunday services every Sunday morning on his YouTube channel and other platforms. And oh yeah, here's why Jenny's got it. Paw is 314. That's pie.
Oh, yep. I knew it was there.
So cool. And anyway, his most recent stream, he goes through the whole children's book, explains the esoteric stuff he encoded in it. I'm super impressed. I really liked how he talked about the synchronicities that occurred with the art and the artist that were unplanned, but actually fit perfectly the intention. So if you're curious about that, just go check out his most recent stream.
Yeah, I've been diving into Scripture in the Stars book. Like I just got it a few weeks ago. And like if any of you have like some let's just say Abrahamic friends, gift them that book. it is like so mind-bendingly like irrefutable. That, you know, the Bible is an astrotheological text, like in the way he writes that book is in a way like that anybody that wants to make it like some literal transcription of past history. No,
And then alongside of it, the sixth spirit world book, Terminalia, which I finished recording and editing the final chapter of that for the audiobook. It's been a long project because long periods of time where I don't work on it. But the last two chapters or three chapters, it's probably about 3 to 4 hours of just absolutely indisputable evidence from the church fathers themselves of the forgery involved in claiming any historicity to the narratives. And So you put that with Marty's book where you reveal the mysticism of it. So you like, here's the real truth. And then do away with the not truth, and now you get value out of your thing.
Mm-hmm. It's wonderful. I after your last podcast with Dylan Sakosh, I went ahead and messaged him, and I wanted to have him on my podcast because I really want to get into the Etruscan gravy. Like I really, because Gabe and I did a pod just a few weeks ago where we were like really diving into like the language of the birds. And from what I've been understanding with the Byzantine Empire, the Western Roman Empire, it's really like putting some things together for me. And I want to see what Sakosh feels about where the Etruscan, like his take on his Etruscan family line, how if that actually fits into the Byzantium, into the Western Roman Empire story.
Yeah, I would love to hear that conversation. And I know he's just continuing the research and still putting things together. And it comes across sometimes like, I don't know, he's claiming the Italians are the only special boys or something. But it's really that we're, you know, with that whole argument that we're saying it's all the Celtic, Irish, Gaulish, Phoenician, Etruscan people were one people at one point. Mm-hmm. And it's just that perfectly positioned and shaped peninsula that is Italy, right in the middle of everything, was the epicenter of it all. It makes a lot of sense if you get into his book, Das Boot.
Das
what
gut.
Were you? So what were you about to get into before I interrupted you with Marty's? That,
you see, this is my ode to the boot. When you drink your espresso with the pinky, like Dr. Evil.
This is a real cup of tea right here.
Well, tea's for gays. How? This is an espresso.
I got some purple drink right here. This is
purple drink is for real men.
But this is elderberry syrup. This is the kind of stuff you might find at Owen Benjamin's restaurant.
Yeah, that's right.
Purple Niggles drink. Fried chicken.
And Niggles.
His stream today was so funny. Like compassion for Lord Jacob Rothschild.
Dude.
Getting hate for just having compassion for the guy is super funny.
I laughed so hard at that. Like I was not expecting the direction. Like the comedy genius is the unexpected. I have to say, for me, it is awesome.
The unexpected of him not being aggressive towards trolls and just acting like customer service. Like, I'm sorry you didn't enjoy this tweet. It's completely unexpected.
Okay, so guys, I have a theory. And I want to throw this at you. And this theory combines pretty much everything I've ever learned ever. Okay. So I'm going to give you a little narrative of when I was a kid. When I was a kid, I grew up, both sides of my family had military backgrounds. And in the military backgrounds, like growing up in the late 70s and early 80s, there was always these flagpole things. They were always putting flags up. There was always like, you know, 4th of July or like the start of school or the end of midterms or like, you know, some BS, Bob Hope. There was always this fascination with this huge metal pole and them, you know, putting up the American flag or the Marines flag or whatever military service flag there was. And I grew up in a port town, like Fort Lauderdale is a port town. So we always saw the big ships come in and they're all about flying their flags and all this stuff. And I always found it like so boring. And I found it very like, even as a kid, I found it like as like this inconsequential thing. Like, why are we paying so much attention to flags? So I was at this conference last week where I was presenting on biochar and I was talking about electroculture. And I had an epiphany, and this is where the theory is. So in electroculture, what you essentially do is you set up an antenna system that increases the voltage into your earth underneath your root base of whatever your plants are to give an extra boost of voltage to the ground. And where I come in is I make biochar, which increases the diamagnetic charge of the earth. So that induces a greater magnetic current. So as I was explaining this at the conference, I was like, I had this flash of the flagpoles because I was like, I was describing of like one of the electroculture, you know, posts I put up. And I was like, that sounds eerily similar to a flagpole. You have a conductive, you have something that's conductive that goes up. And usually the flagpoles that I grew up with in Florida, they would always have some sort of ornamental thing on the top of the flagpole. Like what made your like nice flagpole was the fact that you had like an orb or you had like a fleur-de-lis or you had some sort of beautiful geometry that was put on top of it. And the people in the Antiquitech world, they get all juiced about that. Like when they talk about these buildings that have these conductive copper roofs and they have these real like crazy ornamentations, you know, whether it's in Europe or it's in like, you know, Indonesia, like you see these beautiful spires that have all these things, right? And I was talking about the electroculture antenna and then I was like, maybe the fascination that we had. Like when I say we, I'm saying like the boomers that were in my consciousness as a kid, maybe like the whole thing with flying flags in the past was the flags. Like when you have, I don't know if any of you have built a static field generator, but when you build a static field generator, what you do is you have some sort of sheer cloth that has like conductive filaments in it. And the more sheer that cloth is, the more water vapor it will pick up, And so in our environment, imagine a flag that's waving in the wind. The wind is a fluid full of water vapor. And then it would have these like conductive filaments in it. And it would be not connected to the conductor, which is the pole. It would be connected almost like the way they connect wires now, like these big high tension wires. There would be a secondary non-conductive thing that would have it attached at its highest point. But there could very easily have been a line from the conductive filaments that are in this fabric that's waving in the air, because movement is energy. And that static field that's created from the fluid of the environment rolling over the flag, I bet you part of the memory that was sort of co-opted towards like flag raising and pride and all that bullshit was actually hearkening back to a time where we were always harnessing the high voltage that was in our environment. And there were flags that were being, you know, flown. Like, let's say your manor had your family crest. The point wasn't the family crest. The point was actually that this pole that's, you know, gaining 3,000-4,000 volts because it's 30, 40 feet high up in the air was actually inducing a flow of voltage into your manor, into your building. And so I just had that flash, and I had to share it because I was like, everybody in electroculture now is talking about their antennas because we're going into springtime. And it's like, okay, what's going to be the shape of your antenna and all this stuff? And I was like, you know, it'd be really cool if my antenna, I actually made it a static field generator. I was like, how do you do that? I'd make it like a flag. And I was like, holy fuckballs. All the flag things were probably... It was like most things that get co-opted. Like, I don't know if you guys know, but like a lot of the fireplaces in these old buildings weren't actually fireplaces. These buildings were essentially the new tenants that came into these old world buildings made these alcoves that were actually resistive heaters. They made them, they were like, oh, these resistive heaters, they didn't know it was a resistive heater because there was no more electricity because the whole system, the building as a machine was broken. So they started putting wood in there and just lighting the wood on fire. There's all these accounts of people going into these old manors with these quote unquote fireplaces where there was no carbon on the mantle of the fireplace. Well, that's impossible if you're actually lighting a fire inside of the actual fireplace, right? No matter
what. Like how there's no like carbon or torch scorching in the pyramids. And check this out, Topher. I just want to throw this on the pile. We're looking at Egyptian hieroglyphs here. And I know there's a lot of problems with hieroglyphs and the dating and all that and the Rosetta Stones, but...
I heard they're Etruscan.
I'll just say hieroglyphs don't predate letters. Letters came first. But the right here, you see this? What does that look like to you? Other than a golf club, this is like a flag, right? And this is the hieroglyph for the Neter, which is the word for God or gods or nature. So it's a flag. It's literally a flag is the word for, is the hieroglyph for gods.
What a great catch.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, buddy. Yeah. So I'm sitting on an immense amount of babushka synchronicity signs and symbols just from what you laid out, Topher, in your theory.
Like, awesome. Let's do it.
I want to share that, yeah, man, like working with Mario over the years, I have a great amount of converting the flag, maybe unpacking it from the hyper sigil that it is. And it has to do with his research around the pole star and the fact that it's being encompassed by two cups, by two flagons. The old word for a flagon is a cup, a vessel. And so when you lift that flag to the air, you're toasting the gods of the sky, the ones up on high in the aerial realms, the ethereal realms. So you're everybody and everybody's partaking. We're all having a sip of this belief. And it's being channeled into the filament. You said the word, the filaments, the fabrics made out of filaments. And another thing is the rose. Our flag has 13 rows. Well, the word row in Latin, the letter row is the letter P, and it is in the shape of a flag. And so the rows of the flag is actually rows upon rows within rows. And so there's this babushka hyper sigil of meaning that is happening here. And then one last thing, just to put everything on the table that I've been thinking while you were weaving, is that in Dante's Inferno, he gets instructions when he goes into one of the deepest realms. I think he's actually going into non-hell. It's called non-hell. And it's a part of hell. That's a contradiction of itself. And when he's going in there, he has to put seven rows. He has to put seven flags on his head, the letter P seven times. And so there's a seven, but then the letter P is the 16th letter. So it condenses to a seven. And so there's this unpacking of the rows within the rows within the rows. That become almost like a subconscious labor of we're working to unpack the symbolism here. But I think there there's more to what I'm saying. But essentially, think of the fact that the rows of the field are supposed to be where the field workers are picking cotton. The cotton is the white and the blood on their fingers is the red. And that's the fabric that even made the flag.
Was it cotton and or
to
hemp?
Labor to toil is to row, and so the row, row, row your boat of it all, Tony. And then I'll just mention golf. I bet hemp.
I think maybe what about linen?
But then I kind of
because linen has a very high frequency too.
Linen. So this is a secondary thing because I'm working on my water purification system. And I think it was Isabel Friend that was telling me that silk was used by one of like the Ming dynasty or one of the like crazy dynasties in China as that's what they would hold the carbon with when the water would pour through. So none of the sediment from the carbon from their form of biochar would get through. And that's what we clean. And silk is a lot like wool and a lot like linen in the sense that when you wear it, you're automatically grounded. You don't have to be touching the ground. And this gets back to what you're talking about, Gabriel, is that the babushka thing out there that don't know what you mean by the babushka. The babushka is what we call perfect nesting. It's where you have something within something where it's mirrored almost exactly and the proportionality of it allows tons and tons and tons of layers. And in nature, whenever you're building a static field generator, whenever you're building anything where you're wanting to accumulate energy, like all the orgone accumulators, they're always perfectly nested. They're always this, you know, Russian doll action that's going in. And depending on the shape, it will either concentrate it completely to the center, or if the shape is more of a male shape, it will actually take that energy and then send it on the vertical plane, which is like what a lot of the cloud busters do. Like it actually, the energy comes in on the lateral and then shoots it straight up. So when I was looking at these substances is a better way of saying it, whether it's silk, wool, or linen, when you do the microscope on it and you go into it and like you really see it, they're like a fractal pattern. like each little fiber has all these like kajillions of other fibers that are perfectly mirroring. And it's like, if you had a strong enough microscope, it would just go, I bet you it would just go and go and go. And I'm trying to make the link in my mind, what is it about this perfect nesting or the babushka or this copying of symmetry that causes this concentration of energy? And then, like, if we're going to make a static field generator that is already automatically grounded, like the actual linen or the silk or the wool, it's up there, it's sheer, it's moving in the wind. You know, as we know, like, what rules the air element is electricity, right? From an elemental perspective. So you're flying your flag, you're paying your homage to Uranus, you're paying your homage to Thor, because it's up there in the air element, right? It's moving, it has the Sagittarian movement in it, because the wind is just like whoosh. And the entire time, the fluid dynamic of the environment is going through this semi-permeable medium that's grounded. The coolest thing, like when you look at Gerald Pollack's work, is you can take water, and we see this with biochar. If you take water, no matter what state it's in, and you just have it go over something that's semi-permeable, water is always wanting to go into the divots. It self-structures when it does that. So the second, just if you just create like a little, like, you know, you never see in nature a river or a waterway that doesn't have tons of texture in it. You know, there's always tons of rocks or sand and all that. And as the water runs over it, the microcavitations and the microcavules help structure the water in a healthy river. Well, imagine you have this flag. And this flag is made of a beautiful linen or a wool or a silk. It has your family's consciousness because it has the crest of your family in it. And it has these silver threads or gold threads. And it's up there and it's paying homage to the sky gods. And it's just moving and it's shaking. The charge that's there, you would be generating, when I say generating, I hate when people say generating when it's not generating. You would be accumulating atmospheric charge at such an incredible extent that if you had the capability to bring it to an area where it could be stored, you'd literally have a limitless amount of energy.
This is really ringing true to me. And since we're like playing around with imagining the possibilities of this, you know, experiment, if you will, the thing that I'm drawing to mind is how a flag not only represents your family's crest, but it also might open up the investigation for representing the resonant frequency of the geography of the capital or something, so to speak. So mm-hmm. Let's just say like, a particular area is really rich in granite or has a particular type of geography to it. It's going to have a particular ground charge, and certain you would tune your device to your geography. Not mm-hmm. only would you tune your device, but you would tune your sigil in the work of biogeometry and maybe even the pattern that's on the flag to your geography. The colors have tuning. Red, you got iron oxide to improve the charge with red, blue, maybe indigo, or some other types of charges, or even neutralizing particular charges. Maybe you live in a particularly windy place or something like that, and you really want to harness these. And to me, all of that is open for diving into in this field of study, is not only flying your flag of your family and feeling like you are toasting Uranus, but also really, really tuning in to your landscape and really tuning in through the sigils, through hyper creativity, and through the materials that you would use on your landscape to make that particular flag. You know what I'm saying?
In your flagpole, you would change the actual diameter of your flagpole. You would change the height of your flagpole relative to your elevation. The ratio of the surface area of the flag relative to the non-conductive surface that's actually holding it relative to the diameter of both the rope and that which is actually the pole itself. You know, we like it's been theorized, and I haven't seen any proof, but it sounds true to me, especially after like studying all the experiments that were done with mercury. You could even have a fluid, like my friend Dr. Moshe Daniel, on the top of his electroculture antennas, he puts a mojo cell with purified spring water. And so that you essentially have that nested doll thing. And so how many of these spheres that we've seen on top of flagpoles, I bet you in the past, those were full of some sort of dynamic mercury or some dynamic water or maybe some other substance that we're unaware of. But all of these things that there was, I'm of the mind, and this is just where I'm coming from, was the consciousness that went into these buildings that we adore. I'll say I adore from our past. These buildings were more like living machines. These buildings, the way the cisterns were anchored, the way that they would run the conductive and mechanical elements within the buildings, the geopolymers and the different red brick and all the different types of brick that were used in the fascias, the archways, the level of consciousness that went into so many of these buildings to me would indicate that you just wouldn't have an ornament for no reason. And that's what we've been told. We're told that our ancestors just did things because, hey, we had the time and the money and the guilds to do it. And hey, you know, we're just putting gargoyles up there in the third and fourth story. Don't pay any attention. They're just artistic as AF. Like, no big deal. Those big flagpoles on the top, hey, you know, they just had a lot of family pride. They wanted to fly their colors. No, I don't believe it. Because, I mean, as a kid, the whole point, the reason why I brought this up was I thought the adults that I was around were just stupid. Like, I was like, because the ceremonies I was in and watching, you know, it was just like post-Vietnam, like 10 years after Vietnam. So people were still really sore about Vietnam. So all the military stuff was just like, as a kid, I could feel the pomp of it. Like it was just garbage. Like it was trying to generate nationalistic pride for no real reason other than keeping the machine going. You know what I'm saying? I don't know what you guys experienced when you were kids, but like it didn't feel right to me. It felt like an inordinate amount of energy and attention was going towards these things.
I remember is there was always so much, you know, what drew attention to the flags was when some public figure, usually like a government official or something, dies. And then they do the half mast thing.
The half mast, yeah.
That was literally most of the attention potential. You ever. Yeah, like that was pretty much the majority of emphasis that got put on flags that I recall.
Yeah, how old are you, Chance? Like you're what, 36?
No, I'm 34.
34. Yeah, like flags weren't even a thing for you, dude. Like, you're way too young. Like, okay. You have no idea.
I'm just going to keep quiet then.
Yeah, like all your flags were probably digital and
I got a little something, Topher. I think you'll.
They're NFTs. Our flags were NFTs.
uh, Topher, I'm thinking about, you mentioned gargoyles and like the functionality of these accoutrements of the building. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about augury reading and that, you know, the flag gives us wind direction. But even I think about football, when they're going to go flip the coin and decide what mm-hmm. direction you want to kick off or receive, they got to know yeah. the wind velocity. So the flags serve as an augury reader, a quick, ready access. You can just look at that flag and be like, 25 degrees south, northwest. Okay, and do I want to receive or do I want to, which receive or kick off is actually, these are actually inside jokes for, there's locker room humor. It's locker room humor if you want to receive or not.
What do you think of
but isn't that
the
fun?
Militaristic carrying of the Vexillum? No, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut in on you, Gabe. I'll say that. Yeah, we'll hold that thought. You keep going. Sorry, man. I thought you were pausing.
Well, I was just going to say that we. Okay. Well, one final thought is that we know that the stadiums are actually built to line up to the magnetic ley lines, and there are underground bunker things going on near all of these stadiums too. Michelle Gibson has dug up a lot of that. That they're actually harnessing these rituals and rites. So I think it's awesome that these things line up with ley lines. They got the north, south, east, and west. And when you go flip that coin, the coach has already run the numbers and he knows he's read the auguries. And so he knows how to, you know, play to the plan.
Well, that was like a huge part of my life. Like I was the guy who did the kickoffs. Like I was the guy who started the game in football. Like, so much of my youth was like, I was the guy that was reading the wind, like depending on where the wind was coming was how I would actually make the contact on my foot. And I got to the point in my junior year, the only field goals I ever missed was just because I thought the wind would do something to my kick and it didn't. Like I actually hit the ball perfect. And so the wind didn't affect my kick at all. So the only field goals I missed were it was because I hit the ball too good and the wind didn't do what I thought it was going to do. And so like the augury thing that you're talking about is like a big deal for me. And one thing you'll appreciate, Gabe, is on every football field that you go onto, I'd walk to the 50-yard line with the coach. And what was the thing that we were actually reading on the field? The crown. So every pitch has the center, at the very center of the field is the high point. And it goes down. Every field is a slight dome. It's a slight convex curve on two directions. So on a U.S. football field, it's 56 yards wide. And it's a very slight pitch, you know, going towards the sidelines that way. And then there's even another pitch going down towards where the end zones are, which is 120. Really? And so what we would call that is the crown. So I'd walk onto the field with my head coach and my special teams coach, and we would like sit there like we're like pro golfers. And I'd kind of kick and we'd see where the wind was and the flag. And then it'd be like, okay. And I'd be like, oh man, the crown is like really, really high on this. So what that would determine is, would I kick a very high kick that would have a huge hang time? Because if you were on a very crowned field, this sounds so specific, but this is how specific we got in the pros, was if you had a very crowned field, that's more surface area. So you might pick up 1/10 of a second on the same distance of a kick from an arch form just because the crown is going away from you. So the difference of kicking a 4.1 second hang time relative to a 4.2 second hang time is a world of difference. So in the high crown fields, especially like a coach like Coach Saban was like, I don't want the ball in the end zone. I want the ball on the 2-yard line in the corner. And then that's what I would do. And we'd always be able to tackle the opposing kickoff guy within the 15-yard line, which over the course of a game would equate to like 3 or 4 points. That's how specific it would get.
So this thing I brought up about vexilloids and vexillum, a vexillum is the Latin word for a flag. And so the, this is kind of a goofy photo, but this is a reenactor. There'd be a vexillifer is what they call these guys that would carry, it's sort of like a flag and a standard. And I wonder, you know, and there's versions of this where there's not so much of a flag, but there's these, you know, poles with, and they've got these ornamental tops and made of metals and stuff. I wonder if there's some sort of energetic reasoning behind having this thing like moving with your army and planting it wherever your army is at temporarily.
And having your minstrels too, dude. You'd have your minstrels playing Sir Robin, Sir Robin. And then you'd have your vexillum going. Fucking crushing.
I just can't get over that they call the flag a vexillum. You know, it's like, it's got that word vex, which we use totally differently, of course, but it's interesting.
I bet you there is
it almost makes me think that it means this is where the vote. I'm thinking it means this is where the voice is coming from. The wherever this flag is where the voice will emanate from on high. It's like the command center. Expect the orders to come from this central location.
Mm-hmm. And remember the word for row, like your soldiers would be marching in rows, and the word for row is ordo. So the orders, the ordo.
That's really cool.
Fun stuff. Mm-hmm. Kyle, what are you thinking about over there? You're looking content.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, Topher's talking about the bigs. I feel like I'm just hanging out in the bigs with it feels really cool, man. I just enjoy hanging out. So I have a conversation that I wanted to talk about based on your Topher and Slick's last podcast together over on Topher HQ, BioCharisma podcast. Let me just preface this with like the way that I learn things is, you know, it's really fun to listen. It's really fun to, consume the gravy that y'all ladle, but I gotta put my hands on it and I really gotta, figure this stuff out in front of me. And so I made myself an Enneagram board. I have a nice little schizo board here over on the side. Nice. But what I did was I was thinking, I've been really interested in the Enneagram a lot lately for the healing capacity. And I've even just by putting it out with my hands, I had a great amount of personal revelation of healing. And so when in your particular podcast, you were talking about the new calendar, which is based on a pentagram. And here we have the Enneagram, which is 9. And so, you know, they don't really fit together all the way, but I thought, let me just give it a try and see if I can put it together. And this is also something I'm working on based on the endocrine system. So this here is my new calendar endocrinium gram. And so,
girl, you cray cray.
And so let me just, this is, since we're just throwing out ideas here, this is just a notes, you know, I'm not sold on this, but I feel like this is a really good time to just, maybe tear it apart and see actually like just throw a bunch of stuff here at the wall, see what sticks and see what doesn't work and see if any of this rings true for you guys. So
well, I admire how Gabe does this where he just tries to fit everything into systems of association and correspondence and then reflects on it, plays with it, decides what works, what doesn't. Sometimes just shakes it all up and puts things differently. And the amount of root that seems to bear in thought, I think there's a there in terms of like, what's the difference between people who are just constantly generating original ideas versus people who are more regurgitating or not even able to do that much. So I'm like stoked that you put this together because I can see that there's a lot of original ideas going to be generated out of it. Super cool.
I owe a great amount of gratitude and admiration to Gabriel for having the courage to be on screen and go through his, the word he uses sometimes is mistakes, but I just think it's like recalibrating thoughts in real time. And I think it's really, really cool. So I'm inspired by that. And so anyway, here we have
Kyle, when you've been on the mean streets of breakdance fighting, dude, you're fearless. Yeah, right.
I know. Well, I've only done that in the arcade with Street Fighter 2 or whatever, but
the mean streets of capoeira, dude. You're fucking.
But trust
watch
me,
out, dude. That double kick to the face.
Gabe is tall as hell. Like if you like, it doesn't matter if he wants to fight breakdance style or any other style. Good luck. He's huge.
I get it, dude. That's why I'm like this, like tough nut. I'll get inside, you know, those long limbs coming across. I'll see him try to like do his like, you know.
Oh, Gabe, by the way, you need to get this shirt. It's on sale at merchforbears.com. Height supremacist. You need that shirt.
Definitely.
Because you're like, what, 7.5 feet tall or something?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. 6'5" in the morning.
Nice. I know that reference.
Yep. That's a lot of electrical resistance right there. So let me show you what I got here. All right. So the first thing I see is the 3-6-9 relationship to the doshas of Ayurveda. And to me, this fits in pretty nice. So we're looking at the most bold letters here, and I'll kind of spell it out for you. But kapha is the element, it's the elements of earth and water. And kapha has a lot to do over in the nine position, has a lot to do with in the system where it comes from in India. There's three seasons. There's the rainy, earthy, muddy season. There's the hot, wet season. And then there's the more windy, drier season. And so kapha would be the season of that. And trying to comport that over to a 4-season calendar or even a 5-season calendar is going to have its struggles. But when I saw the 3, 6, and 9 fitting in with kapha, so kapha is the body element, or the body of somebody. And right here in this 8, 9, 1 area, and I'm so glad that we have an Enneagram expert here as we go through these stations, but kapha has a lot to do with your animal body, your instinctual body, I suppose, the salt of yourself. Mm-hmm. And so 9 has a shadow of sloth. And in the Ayurvedic model, those who have excess kapha might have a shadow of sloth or laziness or even grossness, right? And so we have
kind of like how animals, if left to their own devices, an animal will probably just conserve energy a lot of the time, which is one of the things that separates us from most creatures is that we often feel like we need to do stuff just for the sake of doing, but animals know how to like really conserve and recoup whenever they have the opportunity.
Yep. I agree with that. Yeah. And I'll move on to the number 3, unless you got any thing that you want to mention here, Slick.
Or Topher. I know Topher's pretty familiar with these systems too.
I am still a novice with the Enneagram. Go ahead. Oh, I'm sorry.
All is well. It's all good, buddy. Well, for anybody who missed Topher and my weave, there is a calendar underneath. Those pie wedge shadows underneath are a potential calendar system that Topher is working out. So this is a beautiful marriage of all of our brain babies in one glimpse. Mm-hmm. And I want to confirm the aspect of having kapha at the top. There is both of the Hebrew glyphs, kaf and kap, is basically in this 9 position and the 1 position. So there is also a double confirmation because those two glyphs get conflated for each other, but they come into harmony at the top of my Enneagram when I use the tarot cards. So I wanted to kind of confirm that aspect of it. And even I'm really stoked on prefrontal cortex. That is a really cool concept because of the number one does serve as like a filter as you're moving from the doing into the feeling. As you go from the one to the two, you're crossing a very, very important location that sometimes it's in the heat of battle. This is an instinct when you jump from what you're doing to what you're feeling. There's a spark gap of instinct. And to have the prefrontal cortex right there, I got to say, that's a stroke of genius. I love that you did that. I'm totally stealing tons of what you've laid out here, buddy. This is like, yeah, I'm looking forward to screenshots galore. This is so good. Okay, sweet. I'll shut up.
Yeah, the prefrontal
cortex. I can't say enough how awesome this is.
I did have to use my prefrontal cortex a lot here because it is not technically part of the endocrine system. And so I was getting kind of stuck here. And so that's where I felt like it could be right on that dividing line there. But over here in the three spot is where the Pitta dosha, I'm putting Pitta here because I feel like Pitta is the achiever. Number three on the Enneagram is the achiever. And with a shadow of pride, or as I'm putting here, overachievement and burnout. And I see that being really relevant to, and then this area of 2, 3, and 4 have to do with the heart. And so, or let's just say your feeling aspect. And so I have the thyroid at number 2, and the thyroid is tuned by the frequency. Going back up, sorry, to number 9 for a second. The thalamus and the hypothalamus have to do a lot with just like maintaining the equilibrium and the balance of the entire body. So that's number 9 up there. Kapha is the balancer. The thyroid is tuned to your voice. It's tuned to what it's hearing, what you are saying. And I put the word here there because over on Gabe's board, he has an anagram for here. He has Hera on number 2, don't you? Don't you have number 2 as the Hera? But anyway, so I have the thyroid right there. And then moving over to number 6 here.
Totally.
I have Vata. So the third dosha is Vata. And a shadow, Vata has a lot to do with your mind. It has a lot to do with your nervous system. It is the, to me, the really a great example of the shadow of number 6, which is the loyalist. The loyalist, the shadow is fear. And I've also heard it described as frozen fear. And when I heard the word frozen, I thought to myself, you know what? Not only do I know that the doshas of Ayurveda are the elements that make up our body and the elements that make up the seasons of our life. We start our life in a childlike kapha form. We move into our work years in the pitta, and eventually we become kind of like the sage vata. But it's also the seasons of the year. And so the doshas in themselves are built in a biological calendar, microcosmic, macrocosmic. And so just having that in mind, I decided, you know what, let me just give it a try here with this calendar. I put the summer solstice kind of off. It's not, let me say, I started out with making the spring equinox right at the balance point. So the calendar begins at number 9, the spring equinox. Let's just say the year begins at the spring equinox, moves clockwise into the heart of the year, where we have a little bit more of that pitta element of fire and heat. The summer solstice is, it's not directly between the 2 and 3. If there was like an even division of the numbers here on the Enneagram, you would see it's kind of like still a little bit in that 2 department. The autumnal equinox is this gap between the 4 and 5 that is a really important part of the Enneagram, as I'm coming to learn. And I also claim to be a novice at the Enneagram, by the way. I'm learning it, and I'm very excited about it because it's bringing a lot of potential for, at least for my own personal healing and also clinical work. And moving up to the cold part of the year over in putting the winter solstice in between the 6 and 7. 7 sometimes has a relationship with Zeus, and I'm thinking like Sagittarian kind of aspect right there. And then we get to the midwinter, the coldest part of the year, in the number eight, which has a really strong correspondence with Saturn and Capricorn, Aquarius, and so on, and then moving back out again into the year. And so all of the particular endocrine's glands I've mapped on here, I put the number four, which is the artist, has a lot of self-referential aspect to themselves, and that's the thymus, which is tuned by our own heartbeat. It's self-referential electromagnetic field. That's the vibrational pattern that it's tuned to. Number five is the observer. So that's the pituitary gland. It's vision. Pituitary gland has magnetism in it. I'm putting the adrenal glands between, going back between three and six. The right adrenal gland, this is something I learned from Eileen McCusick, is that the right adrenal gland has a lot to do with your projective, sympathetic. Let's just say that the adrenal glands themselves are tuned to the audio frequencies of stress. And so your right adrenal gland projects your vibe, and your left adrenal gland over on the six side is like receiving the vibe and maybe even saying, should I run? Should I flee? Should I fight? And I feel that's a really good correspondence with the number six. Another endocrine gland would be the seven. That's the glutton. That's the food. Y'all have talked about that at length in the Marvel Demystifiers, and Mobius having a strong relationship with that pancreatic enzymes. And then number eight, the challenger, also called the protector, the leader, somebody who has got that Saturnian, the possibility of consuming their own children, but also protecting their own children, protecting their, whether it's the case of the, and it's this is tuned to movement, by the way. The gonads are tuned to movement. They want to move back and forth. They want to, the balls want to flap around, you know, ovaries want to move inside the hips. And so this is where I see all of that. There's one gland that's missing, and that's the pineal gland. And that is the one that's tuned to light. And so for me, I felt like, boom, this calendar is a really great way of understanding the relationship that at least tuning our pineal gland to nature, and the assault that we have on our pineal gland by living in daylight savings time and living in Gregorian calendar, and therefore all of our endocrine system, all of our function as well, can be slightly off balance. And then another thing that I just wanted to mention too is that I see that the cerebral spinal fluid, which isn't maybe technically endocrine function, but I see it as a really important mercurial deliverer. And this is something that I think Topher would, I actually have some questions for you on this. I see that as these lines between the stations. I see that as the eight going to the two, or the four going to the two, and the movement of that through the cerebral spinal fluid.
So what is that called? I forget what I think it's a Gaelic term, like when you do a pentagram and you cross over when you're making the arrow, like when you go from like the eight to the two. And then so when I build my domes, right, we have these ribbons of steel that's, let's just say, they're about 40, 42 feet long. And the way I have to lay them out is like a mandala. And like when you draw a mandala for real, it's not just doing the image. You have to go in a very specific order because it trains your mind. And so when you're doing a mandala dome, when you're making the initial pentagram, you lay, you know, like say the very top of the arrow or the top of the star. You start there and then you come down at an angle to the bottom left corner. And then you take your secondary ribbon and you have to overlap that ribbon over the first one. And then that's going up to the upper right corner. And then you go from the upper right corner to the upper left corner. Yes. And that overlaps. And then you go from the upper left down to the bottom right.
That's like St. Bridget's cross, maybe, or something like that. I don't know.
What's that called, though? They have a term for it. My Scottish friends called it something. It's like where you have to do the overlap correctly, or the magic of the image doesn't work. Do you guys know what that's called?
Because they have it unicursal. A unicursal?
I don't know. No, it's a Gaelic word. It's like a really pretty word. Like, especially with the star of seven, like when you do five, it's always an uneven star. Like, so that's why, Gabe, I was asking you about that with the Enneagram, with the with this overlapping, because I was like, huh, I wonder why in the Enneagram there isn't that overlapping that the, I think it's the Gaelic people did, where they would start at one point of the star and do this very specific overlap, because that weave, that overlap is what gave the strength to the actual structure of the overlap.
This what you're talking about?
Totally. So I want to show you.
No, that's okay. Not what I'm talking about. So like, if you can look up like how to draw a pentagram and you start at the top,
Here, I want to show everybody an amazing trick. This is way early on my Slick Dissident channel. The 9x9 magical square of the moon. If you take all of the numbers in the 9x9 square and you reduce them to a single digit, a pattern appears within. And the pattern is, I could guess it. It's like 1, 5, 2, I don't know. I could actually almost guess it. But when you reduce it, what happens is no matter where you approach the magical square, you're compelled to follow the pattern that I think lays out what you're talking about, Topher. And it goes something like 9 to 5, which is a very triggering combination of numbers, right? It goes 9 to 5, to 1, to 6, to 2, to 7, to 3, to 8, to 4, to 9. And it automatically builds itself into a star.
Right.
And that is extracted from the magical square of the moon.
That's
Does
amazing.
That sound like what you were saying? How
it is
as I go in each, from the
in each, this is what got me into studying sonoluminescence, because the star, the Estrella, that frequency range of that luminary, like I was with ayahuasca once and I noticed that, okay, when I was looking at Venus, that was a 6, like we're told, you know, that it's encoding 5. But the way it was coming through when my pineal gland was open was that is the 6. That is the 6-pointed star. When I was aware of Jupiter, Jupiter was this 7. Like Jupiter was like the movement of Jupiter and what it was doing was it's Jove. It's like that. I don't know enough about magical rites. I've never practiced magical rites, but people that I know that are into the Kabbalah and into using these stars as sigils, they all say the 7 star with that overlap is what is like the big giver.
Yes.
That is like the initiatory, like huge push of energy, which to me matches Jove, which matches the Jupiterian archetype. And
I love this.
So each one of these luminaries has, I bet you, a different, like if you had the ability to focus on it for any given period of time, has a different amount of points. The star will have a certain amount of thorns on its head, right? And that's indicative of the frequency. That's just an aspect of you up there. And that's an aspect, the angle of it relative to you is that aspect of your consciousness and the boundary layer between the physical and the metaphysical, the natural and the supernatural. That's what that is. So each one of those luminaries doing that pulse, that dance of light that Kyle brought up, where there's like the light is an indicator, it is a coaxial circuit between your axis mundi, who you are as the Son of God, the light of awareness, and your perimeter. because God is extremely benevolent. God always is giving you the ability to see yourself so you can learn, you know, where like I'm under the impression we're here to learn and get better. So that's just my projection on the situation. But you have these stars. Let's just keep it simple. The stars have different points. I build domes that are 10-pointed stars, but for all intents and purposes, it's just two pentagrams that are at 30 degrees of each other. So it's essentially just two pentagrams laid over each other. So for me to have any structural integrity in three dimensions, not two dimensions, in three dimensions, I have to do my overlap from one point to the other point to the other point to the other point. And what I'm trying to figure out in reference to Kyle, your graphic where you have the Enneagram of nine, because I've been told the nine, like I've seen artwork of the nine appointed star where they do that overlap, and it's magnificent. Like Gabe, is the star that you're bringing up from the moon cube, is that a nine-pointed star?
It is a nine-pointed star, and you're helping me remember some of the things I learned when I was into magic squares. This only works on odd-numbered magic squares.
Exactly. It will and only work on
odd-numbered magic squares have a different... Yep.
And that,
yep. And that is a revealing truth.
Is that the same way? So my question to you, because you know so much about the Enneagram, are the odd numbers in the Enneagram? I know like 3, 6, well, 3 and 9 are odd numbers, but like are the other odd numbers, do they all have a certain correlation to each other, even though they're in different, you know, subsections? And do all the evens like share a characteristic? Like, is there such a thing like that? Have you seen a correlation between odds and like all the evens share this characteristic, all the odds share this? Because that was my big question to you is like,
well,
the way I wanted to know why they did the crossover in the Enneagram the way they did it. Like, why the association of like whatever to whatever? Because I understand what it is.
Yes.
I understand what it is in vortex mathematics. Like, that's very simple to me. But the Enneagram didn't follow that.
Yeah, it is. It's a unique articulation of the heptad that is different from Tesla. I have a lot of peripheral thoughts, but they're not really answers. But you're correct. There, it is a masculine dominant because it's an odd number circle, 1 through 9. It has 5 males and 4 females in the group. Mm-hmm. Also, with my symposium work, they literally send the women out of the room ceremoniously and make little jokes about it. So that's part of the reason why the part of the gayness of the symposium is required. I think it's Pythagorean adherence to the prime numbers. Only they send the one female out. That is the number 2. Number 2 is the Smurfette of all the prime numbers. So they send her away because she's the only female in the group. And now the bro time can begin. Now the guys can do the guy talking. And we're all prime numbers. All the primes are odds, except for that number 2. But this is something else about prime numbers. They cannot be divided. They cannot be divided by anything but one in themselves. And so these sovereigns sitting in a sofa ring are complete, whole, and intact. They are not divided whatsoever amongst their own self, their own essence of being. And so that's another aspect of why the symposium, I think, is shit-coded with homosexuality. It's because they're hiding the secret of the prime numbers. And so some of these dudes in this circle, they actually have relationships with each other. But guess what? Those are mathematical truisms. Number 2, not Pausanias. Yeah, Pausanias, number two, has a crush on Agathon. Well, it turns out in the prime numbers, the fifth prime number is 11, and it reduces to a 2. And so the relationship of their affection for each other is actually a mathematical truism. And that's why the homosexuality is like, that's how I can prove that it's not about being gay, is because it's fiction. It's fiction. The gayness is part of the code. And that's been really fun to unpack. So the primes, I think, might be where this reveal of the masculine positive force of being complete and whole and sovereign unto yourself. I know that didn't answer much.
It's helping.
It's like that Adam, Autumn, and Eve, even. You know, all prime numbers are Autumn, Adam, the male.
You got it. And then one more truth. This is fun. Kyle, you might be able to confirm this or even elaborate on it, that you can tell the gender of some of your fruits and vegetables by how many lobes are on the bottom. Like a male pepper has an odd number of lobes and a female pepper has even number of lobes on the bottom. Have you ever heard that, Kyle?
I have, but I don't know if pepper, I don't know if peppers have, it is a little wacky. I think that would apply more to wind pollinated plants is in particular, but gosh, it's something that I've heard of, but I can't confirm or elaborate any further. It's a good question.
I just Googled it, and the fact checker websites are all over it. You know, that's fake news.
That's good. Allegedly.
Very important. Very important.
Thank you for sparing us that rabbit hole, fact checker.
You know, but it's interesting because I was listening to Eileen McCusick on BioCharisma. Really great episode.
What?
Really great episode. I liked the mention of maybe me and you, Topher, and Eileen doing a show. I'm going to see if I can set that up for next month.
Oh, that'd be brilliant. Three-way.
But she talks about the 12 bands of the biofield.
She's actually getting into the 13 bands now. I'm being a bad influence.
I don't know, but it makes me, just thinking about that, this conversation of odd and even is making me consider, like, is that 12 bandedness and the, it's like it's totally like the 13 versus the 12 is a lot like the battle of the sexes, the odd versus the even, and trying to integrate both can be tricky, but in terms of the biofield being the representative of our unconscious, like the totality of our mind, it would make sense that that's more of an even number concept to me. Cause you know, the yin quality is the more of the container, the whole, the unconscious fits with that descriptor. That's where I'm thinking of.
I have a question about the bands. So I was picturing them, and I would really like to work with them. I think it's brilliant. So just in case anybody hasn't heard, what Eileen was talking about with Topher is the biofield also having like ribbons as a pumpkin does, and them having
like
a relationship.
Vertical bands. Like these are vertical. This is a verticality where a lot of times we're working, you know, in biofield tuning, we tend to focus more on the rows rather than the columns that, you know, cause that's the rows being a Latin word for row being ordo. They get out of order. You know, the horizontal the horizontal patterning of the chakra system and all that. But yeah, the bands being a vertical thing, I wanted to make that distinction because it's something we don't inherently tend to work with in biofield tuning. It's a little mysterious.
In her early work, she's mentioning the discovery is five bands that go vertical, five bands that flow downwards, sorry, five bands that flow upwards, five bands that flow downwards, and two that are flowing in both directions. This is how she described it. And so also relating that zodiacally as well. And so I was really curious if there was, and I know that you probably were too, Topher, if there was like even delineation of 30 degrees as if we're in like a tropical a tropical system also has like a pattern on our biofield, or if there is, a bigger amount of space to represent a bigger amount of sky above in our personal axis mundi chart. We lost Topher there, but anyway, so that's what I was thinking about is where, you know, is it. I think it's going to be really fun to experiment and try to find out where each band is and then what they also represent. And then also getting a really interesting patterning on the zodiac based on the biology. For example, like, let's just say it starts with Aries being one of these, like, I'm imagining the moving upwards one has more to do with masculinity, the followed by Taurus, which would be moving downwards, and then over to the sixth one, which would be Virgo, going in both directions. So you have Virgo and Pisces maybe going in both ways.
I might even guess Gemini and Virgo, the Mercury ruled ones, might be the ones that go both ways. I don't know, though. This is just my intuitive guess.
Yeah, it's going to be really fun. I'm excited to play with it. So I got my cardboard homunculus guy. It's going to be me one of these days. And I think it'll be fun. Maybe Chance, maybe if you want to trade, we can see if we can hone in that craft together. That'll be kind
of
fun.
I could use some work. Like, if you want to practice dummy, I'll swap sessions, dude.
Cool.
You know, actually I want to make offer to, no one cares, Topher. I wanted to make an offer real quick about this coming Friday. Okay, so I had a client need to reschedule on this coming Friday, which means I have that day open. I usually do tuning on that day. So if anybody wants to sort of jump the line, the first person that is wanting a session that can do it on this coming Friday, you know, I've got an opening there. So just throwing it out there for anybody that's, you know, maybe on the fence or wants to do it sooner than later.
So Kyle, you were saying something about the, like, I cut out accidentally, like right when you were bringing something up, when you were asking.
I was talking about the five. All right. So we got five bands that go upwards as if they're masculine, five bands that go downwards. The energy feels as if it's going downwards, according to her words, at least how I interpreted. And then two that are going in both directions. So we were just talking about how interesting it would be to play around and find out more about where on the zodiac they are. And then also, I think one of your questions was that I felt like didn't get answered which is good, because it's going to leave it up to exploration for me to find out, is, are these bands 30 degrees as in they have a relationship to the tropical zodiacal system? Or are we going to be able to interpret these bands to have a greater a greater amount of space between particular bands because of their relationship to particular constellation or anyway, when we're looking at the constellations, we're making up the lines where they are anyway. Does that have a relationship to how we're preparing the lines for either sidereal or tropical based on our own biology, our unseen biology, our invisible biology? And all of that is like, it's a very interesting topic. And I'm really interested in studying more on that. So I was just wondering if you had any further thoughts on that.
My initial impression would be that the more sensitive you get and the more refinement you get, the more there will be an actual nuance to each one of these bands, if they do actually relate to the metaphysical luminary. Because every one of them has a different magnitude depending on the person that you're dealing with. Like when I'm looking at people's, you know, their astrological charts, the way Taurus represents for one person might not be the way the Taurian energy or the magnitude of Taurian energy represents for another person. There's so much nuance to all of this. The reason why I like to have a system that where I can actually measure it with my senses is because I've been working on learning the trivium and the quadrivium and then measuring those seven liberal arts against my five senses. That's what I've needed to ground out my super, you know, pitta nature. Is like, I need to actually ground. Like, I actually need to have something that I can measure against. When she was bringing up the pumpkin bands and five up and five down, where my mind went with it was to my domes. Because I was telling you, those ribbons are literally five, five, and then an orientation of another five. And then what do? I add two to give it a center support. That's exactly the way I build my domes. So that's where my mind went with it. Like, I was just like, wait a minute. She's saying that there's five that are this, and there's five that are the opposite orientation. I'm like, okay, because, you know, the pickup points for the structures that I build, there, it's essentially a 10-pointed star. So when she said that, that's where my mind went. I think with anything, there is a nuance where it's not exact 30 degrees. Like,
I think that. Nature works with a little more wobble than that.
Exactly.
In fact, like, that's, I've not done the observations or exact measurements myself, but I think that might be what's going on with the luminaries themselves, that perhaps we have a great approximation that maybe it averages to be 365.25 days for a solar cycle, right? But what if there's some wobble? You know, what if one year it's 0.2, another year it's 0.3?
Or we're not living in a field of probabilities, man. These things are solid and they're time tested.
Science is settled.
And it
but
has,
in terms of the biofield,
it has nothing to do with your perception at all.
I just want to say about the biofield that in my experience, since it is it's our conceptualization of a human being's mental energy, that it tends to adhere to the structure of which you are currently trying to communicate with it. So if you're like thinking that you're going to see 30 degree delineations and 12 bands, you're likely to be able to find it in that way. That's my opinion, though. I mean, I think that there's some subjectivity to it. Not that there isn't some consistency too. There is for sure like a repeatable anatomy aspect to the energy field that is in my experience, like in personal science of doing it over and over again, it's there. But I wonder about the whole thing that, maybe there's a degree of it that's language, as in it's an interface that we have to connect to our mind, and that we have this ordered pattern to it that we've decided on. And so we communicate with it through that scaffolding, and then it shows up in that structure. So I don't know, like, there might be things about it that what you expect to find is or the structure in which you expect things to show up could be informed by that mental intellectual scaffolding in which you're conceiving it through.
What's it called when you have a number and then you add one to it? I know, Gabe, you've brought that up in the past.
Yep. That's called the rule of Kalel. And some people, the best, easiest way to explain it is plus or minus one. Also, it is the difference between ordinal counting and cardinal counting. And I told Chance a good story one time. I was taking care of some plants for a friend, and he gave me a recipe for the formula for the plant food. And he said, do this recipe for 7 days. So that day I started the recipe, and I called him 7 days from when I got the instructions. And he says, you got one more day to go. I was like, no. I did seven feedings. I followed the procedure. He's like, no, you shouldn't be calling me till tomorrow, because he thought I would wait one day to start. And that would be 24 hours. That would be the first 24 hours. So technically, if we're counting hours, he was right. And I had jumped the gun. But we didn't establish, are we going to go on three? Or are we going to go one, two, three, and then go? And so this is the 12 lethal versus 13? Weapon when Danny Glover gets the bomb on the toilet.
So this is what I'm thinking is like, whether it's 12 or 13, whether it's odd equals male, whether it's even equals female, the polarity is always there. When you do the rule of Kal-El, you're always going, it's the rule of dynamic disequilibrium, or as, you know, Eileen put it, it's syntropy. The way systems work is like, whether it's a 30 degree, like if you have a 30 degree segmentation at one point of time in a probability of that point, that's only in that cut. The rule of Kal-El, the rule of the observer is actually adding a dynamic. It's adding this secondary pressure wave. It's adding just the weight of, not the weight, the impressionability of the awareness is changing the dynamic constantly. And so that's what I'm thinking is like,
yeah, but
the fool's errand that I've run into, especially in my youth, was I would make an association. There would be enough patterning to say, okay, this is a certainty. But then I would observe my fellow man have a completely different observation of something that I thought was a certainty. And then that made me very interested in how other people perceive.
Yeah, buddy.
That's the plus one. That's as in Kyle's chart, that's the prefrontal cortex. God, like, I really think that prefrontal cortex, when you go from being a reactionary being to being a response-able being, the prefrontal cortex of you is now like molding the environment. Like you're response able. You're not reacting to conditioning. You're not reacting to a subset of constants that you were taught. You're actually in a more dynamic medium.
Like Michael Wan says, it's the difference between thinking life is happening to you and that,
yes,
or you're happening to life.
I want to
a big fucking difference.
And that's why I always recommend the B movie, The Nines, to people, is because, and you'll see that in life, is like there are nines. There are people that, whoa, their impression that's going on is transmogrifying everything. And then there's other people that are just like going along to get along, and they're just like, oh, okay, that's a constant, that's a constant, that's a constant. And I feel really safe. When I have my constants, you know, I think, Gabe, you were telling me that's number six. Like, okay, I'm not scared as long as I have this consistency. Like I was floored when I was coming up in the business world that the number one desire and when you break down all sales in the world, no matter what the fuck you're trying to sell, the one characteristic that the person who is buying that they want the most is consistency. And when I learned that, I was like, I'm an alien. I never think about consistency. if I was a fucking field goal kicker, like that was my profession, to be consistent. And I obviously wasn't that consistent because I didn't last that long, but, like to think that that's what people want. They want to know that when they go to Applebee's, they're going to get the same burger every time. And that's like that framework, that mindset of like, you know, the person that is just so scared of life that they need consistent inputs all the time so that they just feel like, okay, at least I know this is going to be here. It's like that scene of Edward Norton in Fight Club where he's like, okay, I got my couch. I got that problem covered. And then you have, as you go up the scale, you have the other minds that are like literally like molding the fucking world. And it's not because of their will. It's not, it's literally the design of the creator is just like, okay, I'm funneling my intention through this beautiful locomotive biological thing. And it's making this happen. I'm making it happen through them. And it's amazing. This plus one, the law of Kal-El is like, I'm seeing that just more and more. I think it's just this brilliant way of saying, if not 12, what about 13? If not 13, 14, because I know the three of you know this, the more sensitive you get and the more skilled at discernment you get, dude, there's an infinite amount of fucking divisions. There's literally like, it's infinite. It's not 12. It's not 13. It's just, we just have, at our current level of observational skills in knowledge and wisdom and application, we can safely say that we know at least this much. But come on, man. There is so much going on.
And the other thing, back to the biofield of it all. There's there's an infinite amount of divisions, but then there's also this way in which it all gels together as one thing, which I see in so there's zero divisions and then there's infinite possible divisions. There's like both things going on simultaneously.
You understand like your intention? So like you're like, I was talking to Eileen about this and I've talked to every person that I know that's in a healing modality. So at some point in your life, you were given the inspiration, okay, I'm going to go into biofield tuning, or I'm going to go into massage, or I'm going to go into making tinctures for people. And then you got some other input energy that was like, hey, you're good at this. And so you get confidence and you practice and you do more. And then, you know, your intentional body, your causal body, which now we're back to flying the flags in the your causal body is now literally making your environment reflect what you want. Especially if you like Chance, you're a fucking 9. Like you're charmed.
Well, I was just talking about this to Jenny the other day, like reflecting on my current dreams with the confidence that earlier in life wasn't the same, because there are things and, you know, I've already had a few highly improbable things that I've made true in my life, you know, like making a living as a YouTuber podcaster or being able to make it work as an energy healer in a way that actually helps people. It works for me. It doesn't hurt or drain me and supports me, you know, like there's a lot of other examples I could give in life, but absolutely that your causal body, it's, you can make things happen. You know, it's a faith question as well. Like I like to tell people my mantra is I have a vision of absolute victory. Defeat has no place in my mind. And that's actually true. Like I'm not worried about it. I know that even if there's a thing that would be perceived as a setback, that's actually a stepping stone to what I wanted. I just didn't know that I needed to make that step. It's kind of like going back to you're talking about the riverbed and all of the stones and granularity of the riverbed. Like sometimes when you're trying to walk across those slippery rocks, the path forward is actually sideways or a step backwards and diagonal, but it's still the path forward.
So can't you see the axis point between courage and sensitivity? So like you have a certain level of sensitivity and you have a certain level of grace in your life, right? So this grace has bestowed very nice circumstances for you to gain confidence, right? And then you have enough sensitivity to take all these assets, you know, physical and non-physical assets that are being bestowed upon you and convert them, like your causal body then is allowing you to convert that into the creation that you want, which hence is building even more confidence. So as that actually grows and expands, there is a literal warping, and it's not really a warping, but it's a literal bubble of chance that's going whoosh. And like here you're talking to bros.
Impregnation.
Yeah. And you're talking to bros from all over the world. We're all hanging out. You get to kick it, like all these things. This is just this, it's just this, that is the plus one. That is the, like that one, the I am is just like, just converting your whatever's in space and time, whatever's in the temporal realm to fit your causal body. And then once that's completed, like once that goes there, then you're like, ah, been there, done that. And then the choice is something else. And it's not, I'm not under the impression that we know what's best for us. I think we have some ideas of what's best for us. And the humility is like, hey, there's a creator that created me. I'm bowing down to this creator, you know, because the best things in my life have been surprises, things I had no idea, no willpower in, and they came in and I was like, whoa, this is a pivot. This is a complete change in my paradigm or paradigms, plural.
Is there a way to intentionally make room for those kind of surprises? Because you're talking about my causal body converting like the bubble of chanceness into my intention or whatever. And there's a certain element of that where like you actually, I don't always feel like I generate those surprises that often. It's almost like everything goes in a progressive way that I expect or intend. And there's like not a lot of the surprises.
Well, I mean, there's a time and season for everything.
I guess that I think about it, though, sometimes it's like the surprise is realizing that there's something that I want or that would be best and good for me that before, like all the epiphany moment of like, oh, I do want that. And that's possible. Like I can have that, you know, it's not like it comes out of left field fully formed.
I've done a bunch of podcasts on black swan events because like one of the most pivotal things I ever read was from Nassim Taleb and it was Black Swan. And then also reading Anti-Fragile because I love statistics, which is a very weird thing to say. But when people are really honest in life, none of us saw Corona happening. None of us saw that. Like we knew like there was shit going down, but like the way Corona rolled out and everything changed, the same thing with 9/11. None of us knew on 9/10 that the next day, literally all like our American, you know, way of life, or I should say North American, excuse me, to my Central American and South American friends, our North American way of thinking and being would completely change. None of us.
And everybody would get a flag bumper sticker, bringing it full circle back to flags.
None of us knew in the mid 90s that going to the fucking airport would be like being frisked at a fucking maximum security prison, you know, from the 2000s on. Like people had no idea. Like when you used to go fly, it used to be an event and you looked good and people treated you well and you got higher quality things at the airport and it was a thing. Now when I fly, it's like you're getting frisked by fat, ugly people that don't want to be there. You're being microwaved and like all like you can just see just utter levels of incompetence at every level. What I'm trying to say is overall the level, like we didn't see these things coming. So you have more surprises in your life than you can even contemplate. Like big, big surprises, like shit just pivoted and now it's completely different. And Yeah. And I think we won't see the next black swan event. That's what makes it a fucking black swan event. Like, you won't know, like, when you see transits in people's life, when a parent surprisingly dies or a friend, like last week I had two friends die. I had no idea two of my like artistic genius friends were going to be no more. Like, I had no idea about that. And it just happens. And you're like, what? Like, you know, there's just so many weird things like that in life. And I think when you embrace the implosive aspect of you, like if you could throw, Kyle, if you could throw that graphic up again of your chart of like the yin aspect or the whole chart. And but who had that? Okay. So like.
Nice one, Kyle. You just did that with your mind.
It was like my little mind wand.
Can you explain to people the difference in, from your perspective, of the yin energy relative to the yang energy? Because I want to liken this to light. And then I also want to liken this to receiving relative to projecting.
Yeah, that's where things might get a little funky and not actually fit completely well. And actually, I really like the word dynamic disequilibrium, because I really like how, I mean, this is what you see in a flower. This is what you see in a flower head, in a sunflower, in a pine cone, that dynamic disequilibrium that will always be turning and creating and creating and creating, and not necessarily fit real properly. But I see pitta, the pitta dosha and aspects of pitta dosha to be mostly projective, have this quality of heat projection of heat. And so having that over there with the summer solstice and in the feeling center of the body too, the 2, 3, and 4. And then the mind center is the 5, 6, and 7 area. And the mind center is the word I'm using is mind, because that's the way that it's usually explained in Enneagram words. But we could say the receiver of our experiences, and if that is a little bit more specific way of saying it. And so having that relate with the vata dosha as well, as vata being, activated by the environment itself, as opposed to projecting itself onto the environment, like the fire, and creating that environment, like the pitta, like the summer. And then kapha being more like stable, like earth, like our body. And I'm putting this into the action center, which is, to me is a little tricky, because I felt like, you know, maybe pitta would be a good indication over here in the active center, 8, 9, and 1. But I really feel like there's, with that 9 right there being at the top and having the balance, I really feel like that has a lot to do with this balance between all of the elements together, and everything is held together by the salt, by the earth, by the kapha, by the water and earth elements. Go ahead.
This is where you and I kind of diverge a little bit with things. And I'm not saying I'm right. This is just what I'm saying, how I experience it. So the Vata people I know are swayed by their environment because of that air element, but they don't really receive. In fact, when people are overly vata, it's impossible for them to receive. The pitta, I would move to the action orientation. I'd move it to the top, to the 9 spot, because the quality of light there is more of what I experience. I think you and I talked about it in our pod. And I want to ask you guys if this is your experience. So when light is moving towards you, like say in the morning, when light is moving from the east, and you're able to discern the difference from the temperature, because I'm not talking about thermal gain. I'm not talking about the land warming up because of the length of the cooking of the sun above you. What I'm talking about is the actual quality of the light coming from the east is a more piercing light. And the example that I give consistently is that at 11 o'clock, let's say you're on June 21st, and let's say that is, you know, excuse me, you're at this the spring equinox, not equinox. You're at the spring equinox. And at the spring equinox, right at 11 o'clock, you were to perceive the sun on your eastern aspect of your axis mundi, the light that's hitting you is a completely different quality than the light of the sun at 1 o'clock. Now, technically, the sun is both, it's at the same angle, just at a different orientation, correct? But when you feel the sunlight moving away from you, it has a different quality. The quality of pitta is penetrative. When you're around a pitta, and I'm penetrative. I fucking mold my environment. Like when I want something, my will, it's happening. The pitta penetrates. And that's the eastern light. It's not the western light. The western light, as soon as the sun passes the zenith over your axis mundi, even if it's at the same distance and even if the ground has thermal gain, pay attention. The light is actually diminishing. It's not as penetrative. Have you guys experienced that?
100%. That is recognized in Ayurvedic model too, of the pitta time of day, you know, would be the time of day that you really get the most stuff done would have that highest quality of light. But that makes a lot of sense to me. That's why I ordered this calendar, because I was like, I really got to start living by this a little bit and trying to figure it out. I also agree with you that I think Vata is incapable of receiving, right? It's like, it's really not grounded.
Kapha is the receiver. Like the people that I know that are supremely Kapha, that earth element, it's just like what we were talking about, what we started our conversation about with the flagpole and having that ground out into the ground. The ground is Kapha. And the ground can have, it's the infinite battery. It can take infinite charge. Madre Tierra, Mother Earth, she can take as much as the sun wants to give. She has no fucking problem taking Father Sky into her. And so what I find, like when I work on supremely Kapha people, dude, they want me to massage them for fucking days. They can receive and receive and receive and what about this? Whereas I work on a Vata, the Vata is super sensitive, and they're sensitive because they can't receive. It's almost like the air element is like moving around the building. Like if I'm the Pitta energy, I'm the Pitta Kapha, you know, progenitor in the space, my energetic body, when it comes around a Vata, I literally can go like through it. And it's uncomfortable. Like I really have to be soft. Like I literally have to pull back the Pitta energy when I'm within a Vata's auric field. And then... And this is why I would only train other Pitta Kappas in the type of polarity therapy that I do, because if you're a Vata, like I'm sure you guys have received body work from Vata quality people, depending on your particular dosha, like when a Vata tries to touch me, it's like literally like I don't even feel them. It's like, are you even there? And it's because that air element, it can't really, it goes around the earth and it ignites the fire if it has the will to, but it doesn't move, like it doesn't move through it, if that makes any sense. And so that's sort of what my phenomenology with all this is. And that's why feeling the difference in the way the light is, that's why that calendar made so much sense to me, because there is a completely different energetic pattern with the coaxial circuit when I'm observing things coming from the east relative to when things are going to the west.
Which dosha would you say is the related to the setting sun?
That is the Kapha Vata, because the sun is dropping into the earth. Like when you're like, let's say you were to get rid of all your stories, all your descriptions of what is happening, and you were just as a child, but with like an adult framework, what are you actually watching? You're watching light drop into the ground. That's what you're seeing. So there is the Kapha, like the Kapha is the ground. And then this light, this orb, this electrical, because there's an electrical component to that type of light. You know, light in general, even when you're looking at fire, certain fires have like a snappy uranium, like, you know, popping and crackling, like when you're not like aware of it. Like when you really, like the sunsets that I'd watch in South Florida, like over the Keys and stuff, you would see like this, like it's almost like you could see like the, just all these weird things happening off the orb of the sun. So there's an electrical component to it. And there's also obviously the thermal component, which would be considered pitta, but because the energy is dropping and it's going down, it's a relaxing energy. I never find pitta to be a relaxing energy. The pitta energy is, at least in my consciousness,
it's an agitating energy.
It's an agitant.
I'm super pitta. Like, ask my wife. It's like, it's sometimes I'm just, the way I do things is just rough or agitating, and I have,
well, because she's so super vata, dude. I could only imagine like how like the combination of your air or your fire and her air, just that the expansive energy bubble that creates.
Yeah, but I wanted to bring in to the equation the meridian clock. So this is more like a traditional Chinese medicine thing, but wow, since we're looking at things correlated to wheels and calendars and all that, I would like to see one of you synchro mystic senseis take on this particular chart of correspondences, because in my experience I've found at least parts of this to be very true, and it might be entirely true. It's just different levels of sensitivity. Like, for example, okay, so let me back it up, according to traditional Chinese medicine, our organ systems and our circadian rhythm circulate energy through our body and organs, where at different times of day, like a clock, a certain part of the body is at a higher level of function or more likely to kick off processes because it's getting more of the energy of your system. Like your system focuses on that. Sort of like, I don't know, a computer might have a time of day that it runs the virus scan or something. So like for me, for example, one of the things I notice really clearly is that in this time frame between 5 p.m. and 7 p.m., like if I've had and that's correlated to the kidneys. If I've had a day where I overdid it on caffeine or coffee, or I'm dehydrated, I won't feel it in a negative sense until 5 o'clock. And it's like, as soon as the clock ticks over to five, all of a sudden I'm feeling that like soreness in the kidneys area. Like, ah, I'm dehydrated. I've over caffeinated. I'm too acidic. And it's because that's the time frame where now the kidneys are getting the extra energy. So they're trying to do something about the problem while they have the spotlight, so to speak. So I like the Qigong movements that I like to do is also based in circulating the energy in, through the major meridian systems that can, the 12 meridians that connect to these aspects of our body and these organs in the proper order so that you're circulating, like you're energizing one part and then flowing to the next part and then flowing to the next part in this specific order. So you guys have any experience with this meridian clock? I find it to be pretty interesting.
I've studied it before. And so there's a similar one that came up in my schooling and education for Ayurveda. This is the Chinese version with the Chinese elements. And there's two fires on here as well. So this just circles back to what we were talking about earlier with the bands and this arbitrary amount of degrees. I'm not exactly the easiest student for my teachers a lot of times because I really don't understand how arbitrary numbers that we have on a clock can be reflective of something that's biological. And a pattern like this, but I do understand the framework is so much more simple when we go back to the calendar that Topher brought up in his podcast. What was that guest name? I can't remember.
Tom Sherman.
Tom Sherman, yeah. And the newcalendar.com, because it has to do with angles and degrees of light as opposed to the times of the clock. And so to me, this is a nice guide. And I definitely feel, if you're waking up at, if I'm waking up too early, it's going to take me a little bit. I'm not going to have a bowel movement until after 7 PM or 7 AM. Let me put it that way. It's got to complete its cycle, at least in my case. And so certain other things I feel like are really important here to consider, like if you stay up late at night to nourish your gallbladder and liver, for example, because it's
or like in the water range between 3 to 7 PM, like maybe when it gets to 3 PM or before 3 even, or like between 2 to 3, something like that, like start thinking about water. Like, this is my time to make sure that I'm getting my right amount of water in today. I'm going to drink a lot of water at this time. It's going to help the bladder and kidney do their flushing process in that frame. Like, there's a lot of potential health benefits to thinking this way.
That carries over to the Ayurvedic model too, because at around 2:33, 3 PM, or let's just say that area of degrees of the sun in the sky, that's when the kapha element starts to kick in. And this is when people start getting like really sleepy at work and maybe sleepy at school. It's really hard to stay awake during detention or something like that. You know, you get an extra detention for napping in detention. This has happened to me all throughout high school. Well, I wish I would have just been able to explain, man, it's the kapha hour. I need to get up and use the bathroom and rub my kidneys and get some more water and do some.
So can I jump in here and interject?
You already did. Yeah, go for
with,
it.
With the new calendar, Chance, can you throw up that graphic of the new calendar? Do you have that by chance?
No, you're going to have to shoot it to me.
Okay. So in the new calendar for everybody, think of a pentagon, right? And in the flat part of the pentagon, you have other bisections.
Well, real quick, Topher, is it like on your Telegram or something? Could I find it
probably. If I
was resourceful? Oh, like on BioCharisma?
I'm going to get one for you, Chance.
Okay, thank you. All right, we'll go ahead and continue and then we'll pull it up.
So once again, this is completely anecdotal and I'm leaning on my Mexican DNA. So what I've noticed in my life is I naturally, at the zenith of the sun, always get tired. And I've been that way ever since I was a little kid. And at first, you know, people told me is, oh, you ate too much for lunch, or, you know, this, that, and the other. There were all these, like, you know, very materialistic descriptions of what was going on. So when I was living in the jungle and I first started to really pay attention to the sky clock, I had been sun gazing for about a year. When I got to the point where around 11 o'clock, I was living at 8 degrees of latitude. So I was somewhat close to the equator. So the sun's very intense, but it's not intense like people describe it. And I'll describe the difference of intensity. So the light near the equator is very voluminous. Like there's a lot of it, but it's diffuse. It's not a sharp light. And I'll describe why this is important. So what I would notice is what I was associating with as being tired wasn't being tired at all. What was occurring was at the zenith of the Son of God above me at 9 degrees latitude, my mind would shut off. And because I did so much meditation, a lot of people, when their mind slows down, they associate that immediately with just being tired. That's not what was actually happening. I wasn't tired. It was just my mind was shutting off. So I would let my mind like shut down to the point, and I would be feeling the environment and my heart would open. And then I was like, oh, the zenith of the sun is for prayer.
Oh yeah, and that corresponds to the Chinese medicine clock, exactly. Because the noon time is the heart time.
It's the heart, exactly. And so that's what would happen for me is immediately that axis, the cross would occur, where is the sun is above my axis mundi. It's right there. That's that vertical line of the cross. And then boom, my heart would become the horizon.
Oh, and that fits to astrology too, with Leo being at the sun is near its zenith in terms of the year cycle and Leo being the heart.
Solar plexus. Boom.
Shoo. Yeah.
And then it was like literally the horizontal plane, the circular plane of inertia would emanate from the heart. And yet that pure vertical male energy would shoot straight up and go into the sun. And what I was like, ah, okay. And to this day, I still can access it during midday. Is like, this is the time for prayer. This is the time where you don't eat a lot of food. You don't do a lot of activity. The Mexicans have it somewhat right. You take time, because the way this circuit board is made is like, this is the time where if you really want your causal body to be activated, wait till the circuit, the main node, the main male node is directly above you, or at least at, you know, 90 degrees to your center. And it's a natural, it's literally like giving mail to the mailman. The delivery, the baton can be tossed. It's like you're in perfect stride now with the distributor of energy, and you can just pass the baton. And that's the system that we're in. that's what I've been experiencing. And that's what I'm saying is, the pitta energy is like will. It's coming. It's coming. It's coming. It's coming. And then boom, the zenith is the break in the middle. Let your no will, trust, love, boom. And then the light, then the messenger, the mercur, the Son of God is now dropping to the western horizon. And now that energy is being grounded into the plane of inertia for creation. And so you have that cycle, and that's why this
man. Now I see why Islam follows their prayer cycle so precisely. It's not like certain,
it's a science.
Yeah, it's a science. Like they, you know, you look up Islamic prayer times for your area and they'll, there's a list. Somebody is ready to go with it, showing you sunrise, midday, like the exactitude, like the down to the minute of when the sun is at the zenith is when they would do their midday prayer, not just at noon specifically. Like that's, man, I really want to have somebody on help me understand a little bit more about Islam because there's a lot about it that seems so based. Like we got so much programming about it that's not cool. I mean, I'm not saying that I'm going to convert or anything, but I want to know more about like the esoteric Islam. It sounds so curious.
So I'm Mexican Islamic. How would you say that? I'm
Mexilamic. You're Mexilamic.
I'm Muzican.
There you go. Yeah, Muzican.
So check it out.
So I want to reflect calendar. Some of what you just said.
Oh, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to reflect some of what you just said maps out about how the pitta is the will that drives. Mm-hmm. And then there's an execution point, a pinnacle execution point, where it's like the prayer just rides on the waves of the natural progression. In the accessing of the heart, I think a lot of what we're talking about is the 7-8-3 relationship. This is the most aggressive trine. This is Jupiter and Saturn meeting up with Neptune. And so, and this is actually like the Phoenicians are all about this holy sacred 7-8-9. They are founded on this. And so that aspect of the message from the heart having being throttled, it's almost like it's, shroom, it gets shot off. And I just wanted to point out that here is the passion of the Leo, the lust, the strength up here. And so this I have marketed as Daikyosune, which is justice in Greek, but it's way more than that. We got to throw the word justice out the window. We got to start using the word Daikyosune because there's no better word for what this little jump gap, what it really means. But this is also Michael of all the angels. This is the spear of Michael stabbing the serpent of base desire. But I just wanted to map out that I see everything you're saying in a cool way. And then I want to show that this is the card that is usually holding down the spear of Michael. And Chance, can you see the tuning fork? Do you see the tuning
adjustment
fork?
Card?
Two prongs pointing downward. You hold it by the top handle.
Okay. I dig it. Yeah, that fits. I think
the legs are two prongs and the hand.
Well, adjustment is such a Libran card too. And I find that people with like Libra tend to be really snappy at figuring out biofield tuning stuff. People with like major Libra placement. Like Eileen, for example, she's a Libra sun, Aries moon. I'm a Aries sun, Libra moon. We both have a fire rising. So I think that's why we both had like the similar ability to just sort of feel our way through it, figure it out for ourselves. That's just a theory. So a tuning fork on the adjustment card makes perfect sense to me.
And you both have almost, like, I don't ever associate Libras with feeling. I don't experience Libras as feelers. I experience Libras very similar to the way I experience Aquarians.
I have one feeling setting. It's just stoked.
But yeah, like Libra is, it's dominated by the vata, by the air in that quality, there isn't a deep feeling. It's not like when you're around a Scorpio or you're around a Leo, you can feel them feeling like, or like you just know they're feeling, they're going through it. Whenever I'm around a Libra, it's like they're thinking about their feelings. Like Libras are so automatically adjusting the scale.
Yeah, reckon having a Libra moon like me.
Like, but that's why you're always crushing. It's like literally like it's this self-balancing thing that you got going on all the time in your emotional center. It's just like there's no real like super high or super low. That's what Libra is. It's just this like, you know, it's always self-leveling, self-correcting.
Self-adjusting, right?
Like you get a Libra, and that's the funniest thing is when you get Libras around Scorpios, it's the funniest fucking thing to watch.
Well, let's not talk about that. I've got stories. Like most of my exes wound up being Scorpio.
Hell,
I didn't know that because I wasn't into astrology.
Hell, there's no way. I've watched. No, it
didn't work.
For 20 years, and like I watch a Libra, like the Libra interaction or the Scorpio interaction of the true Libra, like no.
Also, all of my immediate family members, my mom, dad, and sister, all have some major Scorpio. I think they're all like Scorpio moons, like all three of them. It's really weird.
God love you.
I know. I've always been the weird one. But guys, I'm ready to move us towards the goalposts here. Time's flown by. We can go around the horn and give some closing thoughts, rescue some dangling chads about any of the things we've brought up. I'm not like in a hurry, but
well, this is my dangling chad and I'll get out. Is I was bringing up in the new calendar, the zenith, right? The center of each one of the five segments, you know, like imagine the old Chrysler symbol of the pentagon that's bisected. It has five triangles and each one of those triangles is segmented into two. So the way you can look at it is the way Tom Sherman puts it is that segmentation, that center line within each one of those seasons is the day out of time. And so what I'm saying is if I'm treating the zenith of each day as my prayer time. So, yeah, you see how each one of those triangles has a double circle in it. If you were to draw a line from the center through like in between those circles, that would be technically the zenith of that season. Those zenith times, I think, are the apex of your prayer or your causal time. Like when you can really like find that wherever you are in the world, where the axis mundi is at the equilux it's not technically equilux, at the zenith of the sun at that point, within the zenith of that particular season, that's when you should do your ceremony. That's when you should do your special timing for family events. That's when the gratitude and the joy of your expression should be exalted.
You shouldn't on us?
Love that.
I am shooting on you.
How dare you should us?
Is that something you guys make fun of? Because I think that's funny. That's my pit of nature coming through.
It's all good. I was just joking. You know, one of the reasons I'd like to have you on is because I can bust on you. Maybe I wouldn't do that with other guests because without the rapport.
Because the other ones are gay.
Exactly. Or I don't know if they're, you know, if they can hang.
Topher, you got a emergence day, a breath day anniversary around this time, right?
Yeah, like I came out of Big Sioux on March the 6th.
All right, cool, man. Yeah, it's coming up.
It's like yeah, a week so, away.
Yeah, I'm on the cusp of in like for the real rock stars of the astrology world. I'm right in between Aquarius and Pisces. So I like you guys know me well. Like I'm literally that archetype. I'm like I'm the weirdo pioneering, you know, innovative energy of Aquarius with the crazy like crazy weird sensitivities of the Pisces.
I got March birthdays are the best.
I got the worst of all worlds.
And you have the that's a 3/6, right?
Yeah, that's I'm 3/6.
That's a circle.
Yep.
3/6, yeah. Man, sacred, so sacred.
That's
beautiful. You know, I want to announce that Topher has forever changed the term hanging chads. From this day forth, hanging chads will be referred to as dangling chads. I think nice. Dangling chad is much more efficient of a term. So that just happened forever.
Florida boys, and then I wanted to also.
Yeah, man. Also, I want to share how similar Topher HQ and Tippecanoe Herbs are so closely related. Like,
it's too dark, man.
You even have the word herb. Yeah, it is too dark. But here, it's got the H-E-R, and then T is actually a B. So he actually has the word herb in his name. Basically, you can take the word Topher HQ and unpack it twice, and you get Tippecanoe Herbs. So, yeah, you guys are kind of a cavitation of each other's symbols.
I'm related to Kyle. I know I am.
I feel like we talked about that a little bit before we had an interview, and I was like, I'm pretty sure that our ancestors were hanging out in the same town in Plymouth in. Massachusetts. So yeah,
dude, you are a spitting image of my grandfather, my mother's father, who is the Mizell clan, the German French Mizell clan, M-I-Z-E-L. And oh my God, you are like, he was a nuclear physicist, like crazy genius. And like your profile and like the wideness of your eyes, every time I see you, I think of my grandfather.
Well, I have some German French ancestry too. So it's, I don't know. God brings people together in amazing ways, man. I'm so happy to actually be together in this little square box here on the internet with you fine gentlemen tonight, and ladies and gentlemen in the chat. It's awesome. But yeah, I ain't got nothing dangling. I feel like the flagpole. No, just kidding. I feel like, let me finish that sentence. I feel like the flagpole conversation that we had is going to be a really cool science for anybody to pick up. I would love to see some more conversations about that. That seems like a really cool.
Or experiments.
I'm going to do it. I'm going to do the experiment. In fact, I'm already looking on all the different like Etsy and marketplace. I'm looking for somebody that's selling a huge long flagpole. And what I'm going to do is my grounding for it, because I've already bought, like I'm doing like crazy grounding experiments here. Do you guys know who Sophia Smallstorm is?
I've heard your interview with her before.
Yeah, put me in touch with her. I want to talk to her.
Oh, dude. Chance, you and her, oh my God.
I know, we'd have fun.
That might be like the Libra Scorpio
thing. You can do it.
She's like a genius, and she's very peculiar. That's the best way I can say it. So she's teaching me all this technology around grounding. Like I'm paying her for it and all this stuff. And because I'm trying to do EMF remediation with biochar, because you can use biochar and paint to block microwave signals. So I bought all these meters, and like I'm learning the whole art of fully grounding. And that's been a context for me ever since I've been a polarity therapist. So now it's like getting really scientific with it. So I have this idea with the flagpole. You have your flagpole. I go ahead and mount that to the ground. I put that in a concrete footer where I use basalt. I don't use steel. And the basalt won't block the telluric current of the ground. And then what I do is, as I bring the conductor down and through my bed, the final terminus of the conductor, I make into a Tesla pancake coil. because Tesla was emphatic that the pancake coil, whenever you do a coil on a vertical plane, you lose, it goes back to like the 369 dynamic. It's a thing that John Worrell Keeley talked about too, is you lose the pulse, the lateral pulse of the magnetic field when you go vertical with your coil. So if you do a if you do a coil like a pancake where it lays flat, when the magnetic pulse is going out or when the magnetic pulse is coming in, it's amplified because once again, we have perfect nesting. So what I'll do is in the experiment is I'll get the biggest flagpole that I can get. I'll put that in the southern part of my bed. I'll put a mojo at the top with structured water. Then I'll have somebody make me a flag. I'll put my family crest that has three wolves on it. I have my, you know, Gardner Mizell family crest. I'll have that made. I'll put the silver iodide threads through it, and I'm going to run that down. Yeah, dude. Chance, we got to talk. That's so cool.
Well, they're talking about my hat in the chat, so I'm showing them my hat.
That's badass, man.
It's Android Jones hat. And no, Mic Mac, you cannot have it. It's even got a stash pocket.
That's cool. Nice. Got that stash up in there. On your temple, dog.
So, Topher, I want to tell you, Ulysses had a sacred bed that was built into the oak. Some say it was an olive tree. I think that's been altered over time. But he built his bed around the sacred tree. And his wife tested him. When he got home, she was like, "Yo, hey maids, make sure you move the bed out of our bedroom and let's make a new living arrangement for our visitor here." He's like, "You had somebody move my bed?" And he like started to lose his shit. He was going to really like completely lose his composure. And she's like, "Gotcha," and that was a test on him. She knew that he knew. She knows that he knows that only he can disassemble the bed because he made it built into the central tree of the household. And so I just wanted to share that this is sacred mythology that you're gonna be dabbling in. That's very powerful.
Oh, guys, I can't wait to share with you our house design. Like when I show you the house design and like what materials I'm using where relative to the geometry of the building, and then what's building the dynamic disequilibrium of the feng shui. Like there's like no angles of sorrow in this thing. It's like, I'm super excited to build this thing.
One last question. What direction will you orient your bed? Like which direction will your head point?
Yeah.
To the north.
Okay.
To the center.
Okay.
I've tried everything because I've been big on bed tilting, bed orientation. I've built so many homes for, like, my last big client was a Vastu master. Like that's what he did. And so he trained me up on Vastu. And he's the one that we put all the biochar in the walls to block all EMFs. We had his ceiling height relative to his bed at a very specific ratio. Like there were so many details of that system in his house. Like, you know, when you guys see the spiral roof on my website, that's his house. That's the reciprocal roof. And his whole house is shaped like a conch shell. So if you could see through that roof, it's a big vortex that we did on the phi ratio. Awesome. It's a conch shell. And so that house is like a very special creation for me.
That's so cool.
And yeah, that's the reciprocal roof. That's over his mezzanine in the middle of his house. So all the ratios that we did of the ceiling to the mezzanine and then the ceiling in the bedrooms relative to the bed height and then all the rooms being completely grounded out and then EMF blocked. Like all that was an endeavor. An endeavor of endeavors.
Wow. Brilliant.
I'm impressed with you still having so much steam here at 9:30. Gardner.
Oh, dude, I a lot of people don't understand. Like when I first moved back to the States, I was in a whole world of hurt from a health perspective. And I
meant to say you look good. Like you look like your whole thing is healthier. I don't know.
Yeah.
So good.
Yeah, I got my piss and vinegar back. It took me about a year and a half, 2 years. I had a very, very hard Saturn mid transit. So I got through that. I survived the move back into the matrix, and I feel I'm running on all cylinders now.
Kick ass, man.
Yeah, man.
That can only be good for us who benefit from all that piss and vinegar, dude. Thank you for being here, coming on. All three of you, of course. Thank you to all three of you. This is great. I love that I've got friends like y'all that we can just get together in the squares on the screen and we have no idea what we're going to talk about. And it's 2.5 hours later and I'm trying to find a way to stop us because the momentum is so powerful.
Hey, don't be a gay and come and play with us Saturday.
Dude, I am. I'm going to.
Okay, good. Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah.
I'll be there.
Bear meetup in the Ozarks. It's going to be awesome. Just like it's fortuitous. I just happened to have that day free. I usually would be booked up on a Saturday, but I don't know why. Just nothing got selected for that day. And if you look at my calendar,
I swear
to God, I will show you.
Don't lie. You're a Jew. You take Sabado off. Sabado is your Saturday.
No, I'm Christian. I take Sunday off. Sort of, sometimes.
we see you with that big old star of David. We know.
Get out of here.
On.
Get out of here. I'm kicking him out of the room. On. Bye. I tried. It didn't work. I clicked the kick button. That would have been really funny. But we are going to take off, guys. Topher HQ, Typical New Herbs, Slick Dissonant on YouTube. Oh, Gabe, you got a Chad?
Oh, I was just going to say, Topher usually drops a smoke bomb and just disappears. That would be the first time that you did it for him.
I know. I tried to kick him. It didn't work. He's got some sort of weird juju. He blocked me.
Piss and vinegar.
He's kicking his own vinegar. Piss.
Is he pregnant? Then you get your, are you pregnant with your astral body? Are you pregnant?
Oh, yeah. I'm squirts inside himself there. So
yeah.
I'm constantly impregnating myself.
So, but
you know my new bear name? It's Avant Gardner Bear.
It's not as good, but it's still good.
I thought it was really good. Avant Gardner Bear?
I haven't picked a bear name.
BB always gives me new ones, so I just roll with it.
That's exactly.
I've been Arch Bear, I've been Domesteading Bear, I've been Squirts Inside Himself, which is the most popular, and now Avant Gardner Bear.
All right. So check the show notes, the description, see all the ways you can support my channel. Get yourself a Biofield Tuning. My favorite affiliation is with Kyle over at Tippecanoe Herbs. Go to his website. Pick up some great medicine, put in Interverse for the coupon code. It's a win-win all around. Top gravy. Yeah, this was an awesome stream. You guys, love you all.
Love you guys. See you soon. Yeah.